So what we get into now is continuing the idea we just started. What's it mean to integrate all these projections, or to come to consciousness of all these projections we've just spent the last 160 pages talking about? There are 1, 2, 3, 4 sections. The return, let's look at those each very briefly. The idea with integrating projections is that you return to yourself, which really says a lot, that the projection is a way of recovering who you once were. You know, T.S. Eliot's returning to the place and knowing it for the first time. That's very much Jung's idea. One of my favorite sections is the eye. One of the key images that we'll see here in dreams, I think there's one in that painting order too, I gotta check it, is the eye as a symbol of understanding. And that there is something in us looking at us. Recollection is very similar to the idea of return, that we are not building ourselves, but we are rebuilding ourselves.
That reminded me so much of that series of images we were looking at in the Red Book, you know, at the end of Thursday's class, all those little pieces being pulled into the center.
Yeah,
do you remember that series?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then a particular section I like is how does this all tie into social relationships? Something Jung didn't talk much about, but she picks up. Then she goes, she starts off with a fairy tale that she referred to in chapter 5. Remember the motif of flight that we talked about. After the escape from the demon, the horse asks to be slaughtered. I just mentioned right there a very important image is that there aren't many rules of thumb, but one good rule of thumb is don't harm animals in your dreams unless they ask for it. Meaning, instincts know of their own transformation. We aren't supposed to try to transform them. I say that partly because we're all been infected by the Christian sacrifice stuff. Give it up, and don't give up until it says, give me up. Now, let's look at what she says about halfway down that first paragraph. The slaughter means an analysis of instinct, which had hitherto functioned unconsciously.
Sorry.
161, middle of that first paragraph. The slaughter means an analysis of dissolution of instinct, which had hitherto functioned unconsciously. This corresponds to an act of reflection through which the genuine content, this is the reason I'm mentioning it, a spiritual urge that previously had been concealed within the instinct comes to light. So behind a projection, there's instinct, in other words, desire to have the thing or to be in relationship with the thing or to avoid the thing you either love or hate. And as that instinct is made conscious, it should yield another piece of your personality to you. That's what I would call the spiritual urge. Another skill, another attitude, another strength. another interest, and so on. The psychological meaning of the partition into four parts, as Jung writes, is a reduction to order through reflection and through becoming conscious. The development of an inner readiness to accept the archetype of the self. What comes out of the horse in Jungian psychology is a mandala. So that by how I bring this down to time and space for myself is by working on our projections, we are preparing the way for the self to manifest.
And since you mentioned mandala, I brought a picture of Remedios Varo did some time ago about that. She calls it spinal transit, but it looks like a mandala to me. Looks like.
Yeah, pass it around. Who did it?
Remedios Varo. She's.
I should know her.
Oh yeah,
you do.
Yeah,
sure.
You do.
I've got all your books.
Yeah, you do.
Sorry, I'm still looking at them.
What was she early? She was a surrealist, considered a surrealist.
And she did Jungian work.
Yeah, she did. She, you know, you see her, a lot of her animus pictures, she draws that she's always kind of floating, you know, like that. It's fabulous.
And was she what, Spanish or Mexican?
I think she was Mexican.
And when did she live?
South American, okay. Yeah. In the 40s? Was she in the 40s? She was still working in the 70s.
Was she?
She became an artist because she had a bad injury at the...
She portrays a lot of her demons, too.
She doesn't have her
demons. I don't know. It's almost as though there was more demon work going on than... You see images of the self.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. That's why that was so unusual.
Mm-hmm.
She's a lot of spiral images.
Mm. That thing is spiraling downward, not spiraling towards consciousness.
Mm. Maybe she was going down to get
by.
And as an artist, don't you have to spiral up and down?
Yeah, I would yell for
it. Oh, yeah. Wow.
I should have got one. Well, I should have called you.
Yeah, bring it.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll make a note for next
time. I'm always ready to learn and increase my knowledge of the arts. Well, the point that I like there is how we have to develop our ability to receive this thing. And that is not self-evident. And common sense, reflection, self-knowledge, that's all about withdrawing projections. A little bit further down, the fact that the horse, I see that.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the horse instinct itself asks for its own death contains the implication that that impulse to reflection comes finally from the unconscious, more precisely from the self. How what she's doing now, she's casting this whole idea of understanding in the framework of the self. The middle of the second paragraph on 161.
About 10 lines up.
In other words, there's a type of reflection which is just ego vanity. And there's a type of reflection which comes from a deeper level. And I think the rest is familiar to us. When reflection occurs together with insight into the projection, it is very closely related to the phenomenon of deep moral change, of the Pauline metanoia. And as you know, as far as Jung's concerned, this is what a religious person is. A religious person is someone who's been changed by this. Not this, nothing to do with church or nothing to do with belief, but with having been seized by a deeper process.
I looked up the word metanoia, and etymologically, it's beyond perception.
Is it really? Mm-hmm. I think from Paul, it's about a complete change of attitude. Maybe beyond your previous way of conceiving yourself, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now she introduces an image, which she'll carry through this section, of the I Ching. That knowledge is a return. Maybe that's obvious then. If we go down a little bit further, when the time for return has come, anybody see that? Mm-hmm. A man should not take shelter. What she's doing here is she's quoting or paraphrasing from the I Ching. A man should not take shelter in trivial excuses, but should look within and examine himself. And if he has done something wrong, he should make a noble-hearted resolve to confess his fault. I think an important sentence follows that. If one misses this moment in time, utter misfortune befalls one. Misfortune has its inner cause in a wrong attitude toward the world. And she's leading up to this sentence. We have a dual aspect of the return, as in the well-known question of works or grace. In other words, we have to set the precondition, but the insight is grace. There's a phrase that has stuck in my mind for those of you who did the Living Symbol, that she said we have to provoke grace. We take the step in trying to scrutinize ourselves, but this capacity for deeper reflection comes as a gift. And she talks again about disappointment, getting stuck in a disappointment. And then the insight flows from inside. And then the humility of it there, the last couple of sentences on the first paragraph, 163. The most painful part of this process is the recognition that through the previous wrong attitude or behavior, one has lost a valuable time, or has even, through one's sacred commissions, been guilty of very serious misdeeds. And then she gave the example of the crazy woman. That's probably clear, huh? And then bottom 164 to 165, how the return of light in the spring is an apt metaphor for the process of coming to consciousness, which is flows from inside after we've done the work of scrutiny. And the warning that this can't be forced.
So the art of the work is knowing when the time is right.
Yep. That wasn't too hard. That was just pretty much what we've been doing. But this next section, I think, is very rich. And maybe we'll go through that carefully. The I. Let me just check and see if it's in this book. Excuse me. Philip Mysteries. If it's in the... No, it's in here. You know, you see the eye in all those early Egyptian paintings, and in some of the very early Minoan ones, there are eyes spread about, and it's one of the earliest images of God. I think what's so important is that when we dream of being seen. You'd think it would be nice, but it's not. Because that seer sees us from the point of view of what we could be and makes a comparison with what we are. And that is guilt. Guilt is not doing wrong things. Guilt is that difference.
The disparity between what the mirror is showing and how you see yourself in that mirror?
Say that again.
The disparity between what the mirror is showing you and how you see yourself in that mirror.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I could explain something of the
Evil
stepmother in Snow White.
Keep going.
Well, I'm just playing with this.
You don't play away.
I don't know where else to go.
You're on to something.
And that eventually what you hope for in individuation is those two images are the same for the most part. Because we cannot always do what the self wants us to do. So they each have an effect on the other, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that was my experience of Anfang. She knows I'm a phony.
Bam!
That you had the feeling of being seen in comparison to your essence. And it wasn't a judgment. But it was a recognition. And it was very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, there was a human warmth there. That must be what the self is then.
Uncomfortable warmth.
Uncomfortable warmth. It's funny, but not moralistically judging. Very weird. So, the other point is that there is something in us seeing us. And it's an active intelligence. It is not an introject. You know that word from the psychoanalytic school? That these things in ourselves, let's say what dreams symbolize, these parts of ourselves, are things that have jumped inside of us through our upbringing. And what the I implies is that it is a unique viewer viewing us inside us. And It's scary. So she says, 1, 2, 3, 4 lines down. That new section, page 165. Another inner subject watches us in dreams. It sees us as too anxious, too reckless, too immoral, or too anything else that seems to be a deviation from the norm of wholeness. And I might even add the norm of our wholeness. The inner eye of self-recognition, which mediates a different view of ourselves and does the ego, was described long ago by Gerhard Dorn, a pupil of Paracelsus, as the real essence of the alchemical opus. You know, Paracelsus was a Swiss alchemist. I forget exactly when, 15th century, I think. Jung was particularly fond of him. He lived not too far from there. And Dorn was a German who must have studied with Paracelsus. No man can truly, she's quoting Dorn now. No man can truly know himself unless first he see and know by zealous meditation what rather than who he is, on whom he depends and whose he is and to what end he was made and created and by whom and through whom. The whole order. She then talks about the difference between what we are versus who we are. It might just be a vocabulary distinction, but words are almost hard to come by here. The sum total of my gifts and weaknesses might be a way to put it. And then I think what's so important is to what end I am making use of them. And the idea is that this, what I am, is an objective fact, a priori. We've talked about that probably many times.
Hey, does that have to do with the subjective and objective? I'm trying to think of where we read that, where it talks about the subjective projective, that just as we are projecting on others, there's a projection on us. And the difference between seeing ourselves as not just subjectively, but objectively as well.
Well, I believe it's below projection. In other words, it's who I, what I can be is an already established fact. Does that make sense?
When
we're born. And then the question is, where am I now in relationship to that? And again, simple, you know, if I want to be a carpenter, but I'm to be a plumber or vice versa, that plumber or carpenter is part of me whether I like it or not. And then you might say the way that comes to be known is to the extent that I don't know it, I will see it everywhere else. So that my projections are ultimately a clue to who I am. What I'm projecting is the objective fact of my identity. I'm projecting aspects of the objective fact of my identity that I don't know. You couldn't project it if you didn't have it in you first. And the way you get to know that what, that objective identity, is by slowly bringing all these projections back and realizing, oh, that's who I am. Oh, that's who I am. How do they figure this stuff out?
Well, we also talked about how they're not really in you.
Right.
Yeah.
So everything I say is only half true. Because as you withdraw them and you realize who you are, you realize also that in this world, that world needs who you are so that it can evolve. So it must have been that there was a place for that already out there in the world. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. It's a paradox. We'll do more on that.
It's like your creativity knows where it fits into the world. But
yeah.
You have to be able to recognize and accept that creativity in order for it to be able to find its place.
Right. But there must have been a world pre-existent in which your creativity will find a spot. That's the other side of it. That somehow history is a bigger thing than we realize. Or you might say that we're born to fill certain slots in the development of our society. And the way those slots are filled is through psychological suffering.
That's like that one dream in the Adler that we did, where she dreams, she's got that flower and she's carrying the flower in the underground world and it's transforming and then it fits into this bigger pattern.
Right. When she sees the pattern and there is a empty spot just the shape of that flower.
Right.
And she puts that flower
in
there.
And that all explodes.
And then that explodes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Into the outer world.
Right. Right. Thank you for that. Yes. Mm-hmm. What I got finished in this timey thing, just for a quick parenthesis, is he's talking about that pattern in the world into which we fit. Mm-hmm. That's what I find so interesting. And he had enough appreciation for Jung to realize there was a connection. He was seeing it from the outside in, Jung was seeing it from the inside out. But it's the same thing. That's work, I think, yet to be done. Now, one of the ways that this I is depicted in myth, when I say myth, I mean religious stories, is that it is constructed from little speckles of light that have been scattered throughout the world. That's the top of 166. That's the, we've used the word scintillae, S-C-I-N-T-I-L-L-E, plural of scintilla. And that we have to create that big light in us by collecting all the small lights that are out there. And how do you do that? But each time a projection is withdrawn, you've added a little bit of light to yourself. And that's a Gnostic myth. Second paragraph, 166, at the bottom, go up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines. At first, this I, from the beyond sees us. Then through this eye, we see ourselves. And God, or the unfalsified reality, I might add, and we see the falsified reality of ourselves. That's what's so unpleasant.
Would that be like the biblical verse of the truth will set you free?
Yeah, knowing, or with the proviso, that the truth is a seer that sees in you. I think this. See, we live in a time of big word, epistemological relativism. Does that make sense? Where everything is a point of view. There is no objective knowledge, says the contemporary philosophy. And what this saying is, there is objective knowledge. The question is whether you know it or not. So at first this eye from the beyond sees us, then through this eye we see ourselves in God, or the unfalsified reality. Jung says the mandala is indeed an eye, the structure which symbolizes the center of order in the unconscious. The eye may well stand for consciousness looking into its own background. So she's sort of linking up the eye with the ego. He's linking up the eye with the ego. She says, at the same time, it is also the self looking at us. The divine eye, which looks at us from within, and in whose seeing lies the only non-subjectively colored source of self-knowledge, is a very widely distributed archetypal motif. And then she goes into several examples. And then she talks about a story by Victor Hugo. I guess it's a poem of Cain killing Abel and then fleeing, but no matter where he goes, he's seen. And after 10 years of French, I can actually translate that sentence. The eye was in the tomb and regarded and looked at Cain. So there's no escape. And then she goes into other examples. I think that's the main idea.
So you think first this experience of the eye outside seeing you, and then later?
Yes, I do. This comes by projection. It comes in by way of projection. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think our narcissistic era is projecting that eye onto others. That's why it's so important to be seen. It wants, that eye is ready to come to consciousness. You might say it's time to withdraw our projections from God. And because we haven't been able to get it in ourselves, we've withdrawn it from God, but we've parked it on other people.
That's reality shows where everybody watches your every move, sort of the ultimate, you know.
It's the ultimate, that TV is
crushing your teeth and, you know, whatever.
It's the ultimate God image, watching you.
Yeah.
It's really true, I think.
Yeah, makes sense.
When did those things start? What, 10 years ago only, huh?
Yeah, something like that.
See, that's new.
Yeah.
And it's bizarre. I mean, it's like, it's the weirdest thing. Like, why would people watch that? And they're every rampant.
Why would you want to be watched?
Yeah.
And people would tweet everything that they think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same thing. Like, every listening to my
random thought that they have, mm-hmm. all day long.
Mm-hmm. I don't care that you're going to Kroger.
Well, there's now a stat that about, I think only 30% of what is tweeted, people think means anything.
Really?
They've done research on it. It's official.
It's a...
That sounds like a lot. I know. You're probably not even there, but it's like, it sounds like true. I know. Yeah. That reminds me of a quote, or I read this in a book somewhere, but I would say something like, you know, some people need to be seen, like, by a lot of people, some people just by the people that they love. And that always just stuck with me.
I think the extent we aren't in contact with ourselves, you know, that we feel like we need to be seen by everybody else on the planet. Like, okay, if enough people see me, then I'll feel seen.
Right. You know, but I'll be real. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like in Job, you know, God in his more infantile stage where he, you know, had to be worshipped and seen and and all that in a way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think this is what's going on. And truth is quite a while ago, so, but it's just, I mean, it's really not coming to fruition. Some details, top of 168, not only the self apparently sees us, but complexes can see us as well. It's harder to describe. But not necessarily accurately. I think that's part of it, too.
I always feel like they present themselves whenever you might be feeling, you know, like you're getting somewhere to say, here I am, I'm still here, and, you know, there's this view of you, too, and it's something that you might feel really comfortable feeling.
Yeah.
And so you just
that's a good way to put it.
Right back into it, so just like that.
Vortex.
Right. Yeah, something will happen, somebody will say something, boom, and you're right back in, sucked into that complex.
Yeah,
it totally obliterates how you felt, like the day before, that you were getting somewhere. And now you're back into
Good example.
I'm crap.
Good example. Yeah. Yeah, they either tell you you're crap or God, but rarely accurately.
Right.
I remember a woman I worked with years ago who constantly got into horrible relationships with men and with employers. And she had a dream that she was sitting in a restaurant, I think, and a man came up to her and was trying to tell her she was somebody other than who she was. So the animus had a view that she should be something other than she was, and it was that person other than who she was which was getting hooked up with all these jerks. And when she could realize that there was a force in her trying to get her to be somebody else other than who she was, then she could resolve that. We never really worked through it completely, but I ran into somebody and said, oh, did you know so-and-so? She's got married, she's got this great husband now, so she must have worked it through. But that's certainly how these complexes see us and try to define us.
It's almost like they have a gravity or a magnetic
absolute magnetic pull
that you have to fight your probably whole life.
Yeah, probably.
But I don't think they go a lot of those.
No, no. I think you can get a leg up on them, but you've always got to be vigilant.
And would those type of things, you would call those interjects more than because they are
not necessarily. I don't know. Could have been an interject. In other words, you could say, well, her father wanted her to be somebody other than who she really was. You could say that. I couldn't substantiate that from what she told me about him. But that doesn't mean it couldn't happen.
Yeah, but what about the guy who was afraid of staircases?
Yeah,
right.
That's the complex he had.
Right. Yeah, that's a good example.
And he was right.
Right. But we don't know what those complexes might serve. And I think von Franz said, maybe it was in this book or another one, you have to be very careful
yeah.
when working with those complexes.
Yeah. Right. That's my resistance to cognitive behavioral therapy. Change everything, you know. And I think some things are okay to work with that way, and others need to be problematic until their meaning is found.
Well, and that gets to the idea of intention that she introduces in the next paragraph.
Well, let's go to
that's
that.
Just an aspect. Though.
Yeah.
Is that what she's saying?
Oh, where are you, Carol?
The second full paragraph. There she starts talking about intention versus simply intentionless aspect.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But the intentionless aspect she's talking about is just one aspect mm-hmm. of this I. Would we say?
Why don't you read the whole thing so I make sure I understood what you're driving at.
The motif, the eye of God, lends a personal nuance to our feeling of being watched, whereas the related motif of the mirror underlies the impersonal aspect of this knowledge, that without intention simply reflects our being. So we have two sides of this great daimon. It's the guiding aspect versus the and also then an aspect that is like nature without intent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like a photograph versus a vision or something like that.
Yeah, because of course that daimon will, you know, give people specific instructions like, don't go there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very intentional.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you go there, you're going to have an accident or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't really make it too clear, I don't think, that she was talking about only an aspect.
Yeah.
I
Well, I just think there are views of us which just show us how we are. There are views of us which would like us to be something else. And there are views of us which have a vision of our future. So that one is just a mirror, and the other has foresight to it.
So like you were, you know, talking about your dreams don't show you things that you know, they show you things you don't know, so maybe first you have to kind of see who you are first, and then, well, it's probably not that linear. Mm-hmm. It's not that linear.
I think they do show you what you know, mm-hmm. if you don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
So well,
that's
weird.
That's what I mean by that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not sure about that.
I think the example that she talks about the diabetes, I think it's to the point. Where does she say that? Right below nature herself. Nature does not tell us we have diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
We must draw this conclusion ourselves and take the necessary change. And then at other times, the unconscious will come along and very specifically
say,
you've got something to get to the doctor.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And sometimes it's helping you, sometimes it's hurting you.
It's a big mess.
Is it right to say that the complex is pathways of our brain? I mean, like they talk about if you have certain bad habits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
In your brain, so that's why part of why it would be so hard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, have you heard about this ketamine?
Yes.
Yes.
For depression, where they're finding that severely depressed people can be put under the influence of ketamine, which actually destroys previous neurological neuron connections. And so it infects or reboots your brain. So you come out with no specific connections, and that's what the depression was, were these neural connections that were set into a pattern that you couldn't get rid of. So this ketamine like reboots you, and you wake up like a new person.
Like right away, yeah.
Yeah, just like boom.
Yeah.
But wouldn't,
yeah.
Wouldn't everything, like your memory be gone?
Evidently not, no.
But isn't that the theory behind ECT?
Yeah,
or
EMDR.
It blanks you, and you rebuild something new.
Yeah, but then you get memory losing,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
But with ketamine, you don't.
We do.
The rebooting thing doesn't seem to work very well with ECT.
It's just
a break. Yeah.
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 No.
But
ketamine
is an
anesthetic. Yeah.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
I mean, it's like everyone would have, well,
here's
the ketamine anesthetic would have that rebooting experience.
Yeah.
I feel it's not so. I just wonder how they bring that about in that experiment, you know.
I don't know. Did you hear the NPR thing?
Yeah.
It's NPAMIN. We used to use it in anesthesia a lot. Yeah.
It's so good in third world countries because people breed on their own. Right. So, I mean, if you go overseas and do cases, that's what we use as ketamine. Mm-hmm.
And I think the people that do it more severely depressed, if I recall, on the NPR.
Yeah, that NP treats
well,
that one.
Yeah, yeah.
The one guy that called in said he just had an immediate turnaround. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what dosage he was on, but they talked about that you better make sure that you're getting the right dosage or, you know, something.
I think the ones I heard, I had to be done in the hospital.
Right, exactly. But he had taken it on his own. He was into
it's
finding
not legal to get it.
No. He was getting it illegally. It was amazing.
Well, the case that this is just with my voice teacher's dog. She adopted this dog who had been at a puppy mill, and he had so many fears. He did not know how to be a dog. Walk right, he didn't know anything about going up and down stairs. Everything made him fearful. And just recently he went into anaphylactic shock because of an allergic reaction to one of his vaccines. And of course they had a filling full of prednisone and all kinds of other stuff. And he is a new creature with no fears, as if it totally respects that boy's brain. He is happy, playful, just like a new puppy. A total turnaround.
Wow.
And prior to ECT, they used insulin shots.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
And there are cases of people who have done things like gotten hit by a train or some huge traumatic event where their depression suddenly lows. But my understanding of ECT is it is very effective, but it doesn't always continue.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people were treated multiple times. So it wasn't, I mean, it was effective in some people and ineffective in others, and again, associated with personality change and memory loss. And
that was interesting because my late sister-in-law was treated, she had Alzheimer's, and they treated her with ECT, and it turned her around. She got back to being her funny self, her really, I mean, where she had been years ago, but it didn't last, she said. That they had to keep doing it.
The one person I know of that I've ever talked to that has had it said it was like finally knowing what other people who were normal felt like as you've been depressed your whole life and then walking back down the stairs.
Oh, no.
That sounds dreadful.
Wow.
So you probably build those connections back up. Or you temporarily go around them and then go, you know, back when it shows up the way they're bringing.
Do you
want
to do that? Your Phoenix pattern and have a pattern?
Yes, because that's like how new patterns develop, right? Like, you have the old ones, you develop new ones, and then you just quit using the old ones, and I think eventually they're changed.
So those are still there in the background.
You know, I think, like, a lot of things happen in the brain. You can build new ones and have the old ones. You know, you can rebuild the old ones. I mean, the plasticity of the brain is something we don't actually understand very well. Yeah.
And that's what he was saying in that lecture, that they're doing these experiments several places in the country around this whole issue of the ketamine maybe helping reconnect things. And he gave the website and everything. He said, we really are interested in people with depression.
There's a lot of interesting things because there are also, like, TENS units where they give a little low-dose electrical shock that they were using procedures, they were using some of those kind of things for intractable depression. It's really wild.
Well, it's 11:30. I'll say we got as far as, we'll pick up with the paragraph, the motif of the Eye of God next time. Backtrack a little bit. And let's see, you read till the end of the chapter. I'd say, why don't you finish the last chapter. I don't think we'll get that far. I'd say two more classes till we're done.
Yeah.
I thought the last chapter was difficult. We'll do our
best. You mean the last one that we haven't done yet?
Yeah, chapter
9.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. So probably in two more classes here, then we'll start with Burkhardt.